Some men make great wars, but life goes on. Some have been despots, some have been fools, but life goes on. Therefore, the mistakes man makes are little things, but his life is a great thing, the only thing that endures. He can hurt himself, he can squeeze himself into a philosophy unfit for him, he can injure his own character, he can bring down upon himself the punishments of society, he can commit crime, for which he must in due time do penalty, but he cannot destroy the life in himself. This has to go on. He cannot destroy it, nor can anyone else. For if any human being can destroy the life in any other human being, there is no justice in the universe. And the ancients, seeking ever for justice, could only come to the conclusion that justice was possible because there could be no accidents. Nothing that appeared to be accidental could, in the final analysis, interfere with the basic program of the infinite unfoldment of life. Most ancient peoples never attempted to define the ultimate. They did not know or could not tell where man was going. The only thing they could believe was that man was getting better, and that whatever he would build continually from greater insight and greater experience, and that at the remote ends of things, man would come to the fulfillment of his potential, which means that he would be capable of a continuing virtuous existence, in place or in space, in time or in eternity. Obviously, this began to move in terms of inquiry. Ancient man began to try to understand in some way this plan and how he could cooperate with it. For in old times, men liked to think of cooperating with the universe. They liked to have the idea that they did obey rather than that they had freedom to be disobedient. They had already observed that this freedom for disobedience led only to tragedy. The great moral structure of the human race was created before men could read or write, but was created out of the continuing observation of the experiences of existence. So man came at least into this world at a time called birth. Whether it was his first birth or his 500th birth, he was here. He came here not, however, entirely helpless in character, perhaps more helpless in body. And as body began to grow, it seemed to provide greater means for the expression of the life within it. And no matter how much man grew, this life grew also, giving him a continual power to direct his own character and his own conscience, giving him the incentives and the dreams and the ideals to build a better world for himself and others. Thus, it was life growing through body that became the redeemer of the race, became the hope of glory for all the children of the earth. And when the time came for the child to make its appearance in this world, it was customary to bring the physician, or at least to make careful note in the ancient water clock or whatever system was used of the time of this birth. In an important birth, certainly the physician was present. And the physician was also the astronomer. He carefully noted the hour, the minute, and the time by the best methods available to him. He observed the positions of the heavens, and it was his usual process to immediately retire, either the same night or the following night, if the child was born in the daytime, make the necessary calculations, and observe the positions of the heavens directly from the sky itself. From this process, with simple instruments, he prepared the nativity of the newborn child. This nativity was then solemnly presented to the family as a guide in the development of the character of that child. And it would be quite wrong to assume that all these nativities were encouraging. They were not. The faithful physician astronomer told what he believed to be true. If he saw a fatality, he told it. If he saw danger, he unfolded it. He did not simply prepare flattering documents. and many of the older nativities which I have examined are far from optimistic. They were not simply flattering productions. They were the serious efforts of the interpreter to try to find what was actually there, according to the science he worked with and according to the rules that had come down to him from time immemorial. It was, however, assumed in many areas that this nativity was not simply the story of the beginning of something. It was a story of the coming of an eternal life into a temporal state for a while. Thus, the nativity, as it was set forth, seemed to carry with it something that has always been difficult for us to accept or to understand, namely a prophetic quality. A quality which implied that the individual's life was at least under a certain general direction. That when he was of a certain age, it was most likely he would do certain things. That he would be subject to certain dangers. Also, that he had certain potentials or powers specially developed, which might lead him to a certain profession or craft or trade. These things were discovered from the geniture of the child at birth. And thousands of cases are on record in which these predictions have been startlingly and amazingly accurate. This, of course, led our ancestors to the brink of another dilemma, namely the danger of a fatalistic attitude toward life. If these things could be predicted, then man was not a free agent. He was in some way in bondage, and it was necessary then to explain how a person could build his own career and yet be subject to fatality beyond his control. It was in this process of consideration and thought that the doctrine of reincarnation and karma moved in upon the astrological field and gave it a certain new directive. Philosophy has developed many schools of thought, one of which was developed very strongly in the thinking of Aquinas, the great Catholic philosopher. And that was that man had a certain limited determinism. That the human being, while within a great pattern of laws, has a power of choice. That he has a certain ability to choose between various potential possibilities. That he may choose to go in or to the house or not to go into the house. To cross the street or not to cross the street. He has this power to choose certain things, which led Ptolemy of Alexandria, the father of modern astrology, to declare that the stars impel but do not compel. This limited determinism, however, this power to choose, is not quite as general as we might suspect, because while we have the power to choose, we must choose with such powers of mind as we have. An individual cannot choose that which he has never heard of. He cannot or will not choose that for which he has a definite distaste. He will not choose that which is contrary to his inclinations or his convictions, except perhaps in a great emergency. But even in an emergency, his own determinism has something to say. Even in emergency, the individual can only meet this emergency with what he is. He cannot meet it with what someone else is. Thus, out of his own psychic integration must come this power of limited determinism, which probably really means that he hesitates, weighs, comes upon certain conflict in his own nature, straightens this conflict the best he can, and finally reaches the only decision possible considering what he is. Thus, what he is must always be the principal factor in his decision, even though it may appear to be a complete product of free will. It is not free will. It is only the possible decision that he can make in the face of all that he is, all that he has been, and all of the factors that have become involved in his personal psychology. But if the individual facing the future of life is regarded as being born as an individual, born at some point in the midstream of his own actual existence, and that therefore he is the coming into manifestation of a being that has manifested before and will manifest again. Therefore, that we are measuring a cycle in the life of a being that is a being. And astrology does try very definitely to point this out. Because on the day of the child's birth, its general natural aptitude may be determined. Whether or not it is fitted for art or science may be determined. Whether it is going to be healthy or perhaps a precarious constitution is also determined. Consequently, the individual is born with a character, born with a destiny, born with a condition. And the only way in which this can be honorably and honestly true is that this individual is born at a certain stage in the growth of himself, and that therefore behind him are things which he has done. Before him are things which he has not done. And according to the degree of his own integrity, he comes in strengthened or weakened in resolution and capacity. As the chart is able to distinguish these differences, the ancients assumed it to be quite natural that such differences existed, and that human beings should be different must imply that they have a reason for this difference, not merely the whims of nature or the biological or chemical imbalances of their ancestors. There has to be a reason why the person is that person. It has not only to be a good reason, it has to be a valid reason. And most of all, this reason must glorify the universe, justify universal law, and present the individual with nothing but that which is honest, reasonable, and proper. The individual cannot have as a reason that he is a victim of providence. He cannot have as a reason that he was born to suffer. He cannot have as a reason that he is merely doing penance. He has to have a reason which leads to a greater degree of good. Low karma, coming in with this same situation, has been a little difficult for many people. And yet many who have come upon it for the first time have sensed the strange integrity with which it is enriched. The law of karma is simply the law of cause and effect applied to the moral growth and conduct of the individual. It means that conduct is a result of previous conduct, that future conduct will arise from present conduct. It implies, furthermore, that the individual coming into life brings with him both his accomplishments and his debilities, brings in his understanding and his lack of understanding, that in some mysterious way he begins life where once he left it off and must now continue to experience those forms of growth and meet those challenges of character which perhaps he was inclined to reject at some earlier time. A great number of individuals sort of feel that death is a release from the problems of existence. By the time they've had 60, 70, or 80 years of this world, rest looks rather tempting. But there is a certain weariness. And also some people get themselves into such incredible situations that little short of death can get them out of it. But these situations, which they hope to thus solve by cutting the Gordian knot of life itself, or these debts left unpaid to be assumed by others, or these poor judgments which have affected the lives of others, somewhere, sometime, the individual has to pick up the threads of his own insufficiency. He has to realize that as he sows, so shall he reap. And as most cases, we do not observe the reaping, at least not its complete expression, in any one lifetime. This morality implies a continuance of life. And this continuance could have no moral meaning if it was a continuance in some other region where the affairs of this life are not valid. If an individual makes a mistake in one situation, it is hardly important or valuable for him to be placed in a completely different situation in which all that he has previously known or learned becomes meaningless. Everything in nature is meaningful. If we are here, as we are here, to meet the challenge of this life, the ancients believed we will remain here or return here until we have met this challenge, that the only final departure from this form of life lies in the conquering of this form of life. That the individual can outgrow life, but he can never walk out of it. He can never escape from it. He must fulfill it. And as he cannot possibly do so in any one embodiment, nature, if it has a purpose in placing him here, and has a determination to fulfill that purpose, and this is strongly suggested by history, then it must be necessary for man to be here until the job is done. Many people feel that the doctrine of karma is a sort of negative fatalism, that it means that we must always go on making mistakes. But here the ancients came back to their cyclic laws and pointed out that the individual, though he may return here, will never be born twice the same. He must, in every instance, be enriched in some way by previous existence. Therefore, his life is cyclic. Even though he has resisted growth through the entire years of an embodiment, he has ultimately been forced to face his own mistake. He can grow by positive acceptance of progress, or he can grow by the gradual negative realization of the tragedy that he brings upon himself. But grow he must. Nature has so ordained, and the stars in their courses have fulfilled this purpose to the ancient thinkers. Having come to this parallelism, by which astrology becomes the instrument of determining the immediate destinies of individuals, pointing out the strength and weakness of character, where they have natural tendencies which could cause difficulty, where certain phases of their nature have been highly developed and others neglected, so that in a way, if this subject could be completely handled, it would be the story of man's present state, based upon the fact that this state itself becomes the power moving into embodiment. The individual is moved into embodiment by what Plato calls the principle of necessity. Therefore, he is born in a time and at a place when that which is necessary is possible. He is moved into embodiment by the very need of his own consciousness. And this need, moved by nature and by the exact machinery of the universe, causes him to be born in that time and in that place in which these needs can most immediately be met. And every part of his composition, biological and psychological, is keyed to his need. And therefore, he is born when he is born and where he is born because of what he is. This seems to produce a very great need for an exactitude in the universe. And we have come to hope so desperately that there are accidents, and that one of these accidents would enable us to enjoy something we haven't earned, that we hate to face the simple facts of a completely ordered universe. But if we look out into space, to the immense galaxies of life evolving there, if we look down through a microscope into the infinite diversity of minutiae, if we study the cellular structure of our own bodies, if we examine the structure of the atom and the electron, we must finally come to the realization that in nature, an exactitude is always possible. That a complete and entire accuracy, a complete and perfect integration of all values, is the common and natural expression of nature's way. That nature, in the construction of forms, moves by a skill and wisdom which transcends imagination. And that in the infinite life which nature sustains, there is evidence of infinite law infinitely manifesting. So the problem of getting a human soul to the place where it belongs would no more tax nature than we would find nature unable to cope with the rotations and axes of atoms. Thus, these problems present no real difficulty if we assume in nature an absolute law, absolutely operating. It wasn't long in the course of the struggles of things that the doctrine of reincarnation and karma began to intrigue the astrologer in another way. Would it be possible, is it conceivable, that from the chart of the individual, he would be able to tell something of where it came from and something of where it might be going? In India, this is a common procedure. And in Eastern astrology in general, the problem of a previous embodiment is assumed to be a correct or proper astrological consideration. On what ground would this be regarded as valid in the terms of astrology? It is not valid only in terms of astrology, but theoretically, in particularly ancient thinking, it would be valid of any form of character analysis. It would be valid in every psychological test that we use today. Because actually, these tests tell what we are. What we are tells very largely where we came from and how long it took us to get to where we are now. It is obvious also that from these tests it is possible to distinguish what might be termed more rapid or less rapid advancement among people. We know that today there is an equality of potential but not an equality of power. We know that individuals are spiritually derived of the same substance and essence. And that they have the same hope of glory, all of them. Yet it is something that would cause us to remember that in school, children passing through various grades and moving up through schooling do not all arrive at identically the same points. They do not all achieve the same grades, although they have had the same instructors. Generally speaking, we note that the child who wants to learn has the best grades. There may be exceptions in cases where there are physical or psychological handicaps, but in total, in general, the eager student, willing to give time and thought to instruction, becomes the better student. Whereas the one who begrudges his education uses every possible effort to evade the assignments that are given to him, would rather play than work. This individual consistently does not have as good grades. Now, it's the same way in life. We look around us. We see a few people who are industrious, thoughtful, well-intentioned, trying their best to live good lives. We find others to whom this life is simply a period of romping. They only want to have fun from the cradle to the grave, and because of this desperate effort, are usually miserable most of the time. We know that in all probabilities in the past, some of us were pretty eager students and others were a constant problem to the truant officer or his equivalent. We also know that some individuals had a natural aptitude for certain studies, others did not. And now we observe these markings in the newborn child. We are unable to explain why a great musician should arise in a family which for five generations has never been able to carry a tune. We have no way of knowing or understanding how it is that from some great and noble family of long and illustrious ancestry and of every opportunity have come some of the most highly schooled morons we have ever produced. We have no reason of knowing or understanding why the privileged do not avoid crime, why the underprivileged can attain virtue. These things we just do not find answers for, except a rather blasé expression of, well, that's the way it is. When we get a little deeper into it, however, we have every reason to feel that if the person is responsible for his own action, if we are what we have made ourselves to be, whether it be good or bad, we are all self-made, and we all have some more work to do. Whatever this situation is, the only honest and equitable answer is that whatever we have done, we must face. Whatever mistakes we have made, we must correct. And if we wish to graduate, we must do the work that is assigned to us. And it may take longer for some to get around to it. Others, perhaps, have achieved more rapidly. For some of the noblest souls in humanity that we have ever known have passed out of this world more than 2,000 years ago. Yet, at the same time, in the terms of that which is to be known, they were the first to admit their own limitations. So we have a world which, if we are moving according to law, can be a pretty good world. A world of fairness and justice. And a world that might be of great value to our modern thinking. I have a strong suspicion if the present generation could truly become aware of the principles of reincarnation and karma and would accept these as basic doctrinal facts, it would have a very important effect upon current history and might do a great deal to prevent individuals from breaking laws or practicing tyrannies which sometime they must pay for. It is this wonderful hope of modern man that he is going down to the quietude of the grave and that his honors will be here and that he has no future to worry about or to fear that allows a great deal of despotism to flourish among us. If the individual, if the dictator, the tyrant, knew that he had to live it out in space and eat it out in his own heart, he wouldn't be worried about the strength of his enemies. He would be worried about the weakness of himself. And this would be a most desirable situation. I think it would do, for instance, Mr. Khrushchev, Mr. Castro, a world of good if they suddenly became devout followers of reincarnation and karma. And it might do quite a little good to some of the people who are under the influence of these men. And it wouldn't do at all, it wouldn't do a bit of harm either for a large number of our own industrialists and economists and political leaders to be indoctrinated with the same ideas. I think it might cause the foundation of something we very much need, and that is a lasting peace. Because it is only the lasting peace that can bring peace to the human soul. It is only when we find the answers to right conduct and move quietly with nature that we can flow back into birth with the kind of destiny that will give us a happy, serene, and secure existence. It is perfectly possible to be happy in this world, but you have to earn the right. And you have to earn the right by graduating from a school of misery, a school that is based simply upon ignorance and compromise. So I think these old ideas could have some meaning for us right now. In Eastern astrology, the effort has been made to indicate how this particular problem could work. And for those who are a bit astrologically minded, we can say that in the traditional forms of astrology has many schools today, but in the traditional forms that have come down to us from the past. The ascendant, or the so-called first house of a horoscope, the sign ascending on the eastern horizon at the moment of birth, is said to be the ruling sign of that chart, not the sign in which the sun is located according to the birthday. On this eastern angle, therefore, the ancients and the East Indian astrologers placed what they termed the now point. At the moment of that ascendant, we were born. And we were born into the present life of ourselves. We were born into the present cycle of our experiences. And into this cycle, we brought something. No one comes empty-handed into this world. We all bring something. We all bring some potential. I have been discussing a little of this problem with some rather outstanding people in the field of child psychology, and they are beginning to accept more and more generally that it is impossible to assume that the child is born with a consciousness like a nice, clean sheet of blank paper. There's someone been scribbling on it before it got here. The child is a neurotic or not a neurotic the day it is born. Now, under certain conditions, a wise family or fortunate relationships may cause this neurotic child to slowly straighten out part of its own disaster, may never become overwhelmingly neurotic, perhaps because the overwhelming phase of its neurosis was not commanded by its destiny. But if completely neglected, that child can become very neurotic, which may also well mean that that child had this powerful neurotic tendency and society provided it with an opportunity to be itself, which is the greatest challenge that can face anything. But regardless, this child is born with a nature and a temperament. All that a parent can do is to strengthen this temperament, to observe it, to give it all natural possible assistance in those early years when the child is unable to function on its own. The parent, however, cannot create a temperament, nor can it completely frustrate a temperament. The temperament is there, but it can be inclined. And as this is inclined in one way or another, the possibilities of the child bringing positive values to bear upon its problems may be increased, but always the parent must work with the available reservoir of potential that that child brings. It is the leadership by the parent, the understanding of how to use this potential, that is important. And many modern people have found astrology very helpful in this particular form of guidance. Though if the first house of the chart does represent the child coming into life, then according to some systems of ancient astrology, the 12th house, which precedes the first, and is the sign preceding the one which is ascending, could well represent the previous life of the person. In Western astrology, as taught by such early masters as Lilly and Gadbury, the 12th house was a house of secret things, of sickness, of imprisonment, of exile, and of the so-called negative destinies of things, if they apply to the individual. It's a sort of house in which the larger misfortunes of the life are outlined according to Western astrology. To the Eastern, this represents that which was the previous type of embodiment. Therefore, by turning the wheel of a chart so that the 12th house is moved to the ascendant, it was the belief of many peoples that a general indication of the previous life of the individual could be found. That it would then be the kind of a horoscope that that individual might have had the last time he was born. That at least it represents to degree that which has gone before, because the 12th house represents the submerged part of the present character. Therefore, it was this submerged part which must have previously been objective, or upon which the individual built all of his previous existence. Thus, in a way, we can get the concept of what the challenge might have been, how we could have failed or how we did succeed in the unfoldment of character. Also, that here lie certain potentials, both of strength and weakness, which unless we do something with them, will continue to haunt us. Also in this house, the 12th, we find the indications of the karmic debt which the person carries with him, the unfinished business which is nearest to the surface. Always this karmic debt has to be in terms of the actual development of the person. It can only be such part of this debt as is applicable to his present state of consciousness. But these things are believed to have an association with this aspect of the 12th house. So that if there's unfinished business or there is a pressure, there is a need to do things, that this need is some way delineated or clarified by the 12th house, by moving it and making it a kind of ascendant and then reading the new chart thus created, planets and so forth left as they are in the natal chart. By the same degree of thinking, the future would be indicated by the house following the first, which is the second house of the chart. We consider this house now as the chart or house of wealth or success. But to the ancients, this was much more. It was the house of the fulfillment of right destiny. It had to do with what we gain by keeping the law, how rich we become by paying our own debts and not making more. So true wealth in philosophy is not what we have, but what we are. And this is determined as part of the wealth concept, which, of course, in Europe got entirely sidetracked, so that it only came to mean how much money you had in the bank. Well, how much have we got in the bank of the universe? It becomes a very moot question as we live along through the years. So in this situation, astrology works with the idea of reincarnation and karma. They operate as a kind of pattern, each interlocking with the other. And if we use either, we can gain a greater insight into the other, because we can recognize the great precession of life, the great motion of ages. We can say to ourselves, perhaps great cultures come back. Great racial motions are reborn because the entities in them, much of the same quality, move on very closely the same time cycles. Therefore, it is quite possible that we may find the rebirth of the Roman Empire, the rebirth of the philosophic states of Greece, the rebirth of the golden era of Asiatic philosophy. These cycles come in. Cycles of war and conquest return. We sometimes wonder how it happens that the world was so enriched with music in the 19th century, when there lived together some of the finest musicians the world has ever known, or in the 18th century. For outside of these 200 years, the musical contributions of Western culture have been comparatively negligible. Its great work was done then. I was reading a work on Chinese art not long ago by a distinguished Chinese culturist, a man of great discrimination. He said the arts of China had a cycle that was complete in themselves, that this cycle was born about the 4th century A.D. This cycle died about the 10th century A.D. And from that time on, practically no actual creativity in Chinese art. Not that China essentially vanished or anything of that nature, but from then on, it was mostly copying, mostly the reproduction of older work. We may say the same in certain forms of architecture. The great era of architecture extended into the period of 2 to 4,000 B.C. Even today, our architecture does not touch these ancient works. Therefore, there seems to be cycles and periods and times. There are periodic outbreaks of great wars, periodic returns of natural disasters. All these things seem to move in cycles, and these cycles have to be tied into a great system of world ethics and world culture. This system, we know, exists. But the very scientific aspect of it offers again further stimulation. And while we know that cause and effect is operating through space from the beginning of time, we have need of a clock to measure the time, to create the great pattern of mathematical sequences. Astronomy is that clock, because it is only the astronomical clock that can measure ages. It is only by some great system of chronology, like the Platonic cycles, that we can begin to estimate these vast periods of time. Through astronomy, therefore, we have the measure of the outworking of the law. We have the pattern set up by which we can measure the relationship of events, estimate their frequencies, and arrive at a certain scientific control of events. All of these things work together, and I believe that either phase of the subject, extended to its natural ends, would give us amazing confidence in the universality of natural law, its justice, and how an understanding of these factors could help us now by giving us fuller inducements to live honorable lives, to accept our responsibilities with dignity, to cease shifting responsibilities, and to settle down to the real purpose for which we are here, namely a quiet program of self-improvement and mutual cooperation for the preservation and protection of everything that we regard as valuable and good. By such a simple scientific pattern, with its ennobled background of great dreams and convictions, a scientific law based in idealism and not in materialism, a great pattern recognized as the production of a universal mind, all wise and all good, and not merely the result of humanistic accidents. If we can begin to feel these larger rules and laws, I think we will be encouraged to find real answers for real problems, to stand for principles which we know to be right, and to gain inward consolation from the realization that we are here to grow, and that it is a blessed privilege to be able to work together in this schoolroom of life. Well, time is up.